Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be shining the spotlight on the big event in the Vatican for this month of October, the Synod for Africa. A synod often presided over by Pope Benedict himself. And marking the 400th anniversary of the founding vision of Mary Ward, by explaining how the Jesuit constitutions this holy and charismatic lady had called for all those years ago were finally adopted in 2003. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. If you've been anywhere near the Vatican recently, you'll have noticed there are a lot of Africans around. There's a good reason for this. There's a big meeting taking place, which the Church calls a synod, focusing precisely on the African continent. And in particular on Thursday, the bishops discussed the importance of international awareness for promoting peace efforts. John Baptist Tumasimi reports from the synod hall, and brings us a brief interview with the Apostolic Administrator to Mogadishu in Somalia, Bishop Giorgio Bertin. Let's listen.
The bishops noted that before the people of Africa can be at the service of reconciliation, justice and peace, they must themselves first experience justice and peace. The bishops called on the international community to take interest in finding solutions to the civil wars on the continent, and at the same time called on states and organizations that might be involved in fueling these conflicts to stop. Bishop Giorgio Bertin is the Apostolic Administrator to Mogadishu in Somalia. He explained the efforts of the Church in resolving the conflict in Somalia, which started in 1991.
The situation in Mogadishu has been very sad throughout these last 18 years, particularly during this last year and a half. During these last years, the Holy See has been trying to do its best. A year and a half ago, during my visit at Limina here in Rome, I brought with me a letter of thanks from some Somali leaders who had paid attention that in a period between November and beginning of January, the Holy Father has mentioned four times during his speeches the situation in Somalia. So these leaders were recognizing that the Pope was helping the cause of Somalia by attracting, keeping alive the attention of the whole world.
You were listening there to the Apostolic Administrator to Mogadishu in Somalia, Bishop Giorgio Bertin, speaking to my colleague John Baptist Tumasimi. My thanks to both of them. And moving on, among the other 200 church leaders plus religious or lay experts making formal presentations and sharing their experiences at the Synod is Synod Father and Superior General of the Society of African Missions, Father Kieran O'Reilly. He took the time to sit down with me, speaking to us, among other things, of his hopes for this Synod. Father Kieran O'Reilly, you're the Superior General of the Society of African Missions. It's an order that goes back to when?
We were founded in 1856 in France, in Lyon. Our founder was Melchior de Myriam Bresiac, with the specific aim of going to the most abandoned in Africa.
Father, my first question regards the African continent. I believe there are over 50 nations in this continent. They're very different realities. Would you say there's a uniting element between the people there? Is there an African identity?
Well, no, I think that's a real very difficult question to answer because of the many different ethnic groups, the reality of the way the countries were formed in history, for instance, after the Congress of Berlin, the colonial history put nations of peoples together that were not together for centuries, that had their own different kind of identity. You have the whole series of countries along the Maghreb, the north of Africa. Then you have the countries in sub-Saharan Africa, and you move down into southern Eastern Africa. So it's very difficult to speak, from my mind, without kind of insulting the diversity and the richness that exists in Africa, and the huge number of ethnicities, ethnic groups, languages, cultural fabric that has kind of grown up over centuries.
Speaking in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, last spring, Benedict XVI highlighted how the church's essential role in Africa was to present Jesus Christ as the one redeemer and thus enhance African traditions and correct and perfect their concept of life, humanity and the family. Your order began evangelizing in colonial times, as you just mentioned, when Western traditions or cultural models were imposed on Africans. Has this changed?
Indeed, we were part, I suppose, of that great movement of Europe into Africa in the 1840s, 50s and 60s. We first went there in the late 1850s. So invariably we're associated, especially along West Africa, where we began, Nigeria, the Benin Republic, Sierra Leone. We're associated with the French and the British colonial movement of that time. And invariably our missionaries were children of their own theological time, with the view that you brought the faith, you converted people to salvation in Jesus Christ in order to save them from eternal damnation. And mission theology, I suppose, has grown and has been heavily influenced by our presence in these countries and by, in fact, our deepening knowledge of the peoples with whom we lived and worked. Initially, obviously, when somebody comes to a strange shore, they don't know anything other than what they bring themselves. So it takes a number, perhaps, of generations before they begin to fully understand the peoples, the very rich fabric of their own cultural framework and makeup, the understanding of the dynamic that runs either the social, the political, the economic within the society that they work. And I think part of our missionary thrust, perhaps not the dominant part, but from the beginning, has been to try and, if you like, codify for ourselves a better understanding of the peoples and the cultures we moved into bring the gospel to. One of the first ways that we as a society had done this was through the establishment of schools, believing, and it's still the case, that education is the key to all forms of true cultural development in every kind of way. Subsequently, we were able to develop that along the lines of small clinics, then eventually into hospitals, education and that kind of thing. So our process of, if you like, integration is slow. Our concern, first of all, is for the well-being of the people who gathered around us. And very often when we began our mission stations, we had very few people. It may have taken 10, 15, 20 years before small communities really began to grow. And it was perhaps only in the 1900s that numbers began to become significant in the churches along West Africa, at least, where we established communities. And as I said, one of our tasks is to learn and to journey with our own people then. Gradually, priests came, we have bishops, so they bring their own richness and their theological understanding of the reality of Jesus Christ. So we are still bringing the message of Jesus Christ, but we are now bringing it very much in dialogue with the cultures of the people that we are living and working with and that we have been fortunate to work with for so long. So you're not imposing anymore a model, say, from outside, which was by very fact that people came on boats from outside, you brought it with you. We are now actually working with the local hierarchies, the theologians, the people, the lay communities, in understanding what, if you like, is the reality of Christ as an African face. Christ, my brother and my sister, my father and my brother, my uncle, who are Africans. And that is a great challenge. And I suppose for a society like my own, it has moved even further in that we are now welcoming members from the local churches where we were missionaries to be missionaries with us in other parts of Africa. So they have a major part to contribute, if you like, to this growing unraveling of the mystery of the identity of Christ in Africa now, 2 centuries after it came, let us say, in the new movement into Africa. Okay, there was a previous movement down the west coast in the 15th and 16th century, and there was a much earlier movement in the early Roman times and in the collapse of Rome along North Africa. But our own time now is marked by missionaries who are from Africa, who are young, who are full of energy, who bring to their own continent this richness that is Jesus Christ.
What about the role of other religions, traditional African religions? What kind of a role do they play in achieving reconciliation, justice and peace?
They play a very important role, really. I think in many areas you now have joint kind of committees. As always, of course, the mainline churches and groups have no problem coming together. Invariably, it is the fringe groups or the fanatics in all our Christian or Islam or whatever it is who are the most problematic at this. But everybody, first of all, and I mean, in Africa, you can see the most beautiful continent, the geographic diversity, the beauty of the mountains, the beauty of the rivers, the unimaginable beauty as you rise to see a sunset, or you get up in the morning to see the sunrise, my goodness, over the forest in Central Africa, over Lake Victoria in Tanzania. You realize the beauty of nature that they have there, and yet we're very conscious of the damage that's been done to all of that. But we are all there as human beings. It doesn't matter whether you're a traditional African worshipper or you're a follower of Islam or you're a Jehovah Witness or you're a Catholic. All of us rise to look at the same sunrise. So we all together share the suffering when that sunrise is damaged through pollution or poisoning of our waters. So our very common humanity binds us, if you like, first of all, to strive for an environment and a world that honours the dignity of all of us who live in that place. But what's more than that, guarantees it and guarantees its beauty into the future.
Well, seeing as you've spoken about beauty, do you think there'll be any good news stories coming out of this synod?
Oh, there will. To me, the big news story, of course, always from Africa, is Africa's people. And the people and their warmth and their friendship. And, you know, I think maybe industrially Africa hasn't given an awful lot to the rest of the world. But if the rest of the world was only willing just to receive a bit of the warmth and the friendship and the kindness and the love that Africans do give and can give, I think it would be very positive. They have a tremendous sense of people. They're very much focused on people. Family, community, village, ethnic group, tribe, nation, whatever it is. And they have a great sense of courtesy, regard for each other. Sometimes people say, but that belies all the wars. Wars are about greed, wars about selfish, wars about distortion. And I think that's where we Catholics, Christians come into play, to try and make well, to restore, in order to give back, if you like, the richness of African cultures that had survived with a very intricate fabric, if you like, as I would call it, of life support over centuries before Europe came in there.
You mentioned Europe again. Cultural models that come from the West, are they present there? Have they led this continent down the path of materialism and relativism and away from these traditional values?
Well, human nature is human nature everywhere, you know. And whether I'm somebody from Lagos or I'm somebody from Cork in Ireland, I'm a human being and I want to have what I can have. I like to have a car and I like to have a house and I want to go on a holiday. So human nature is human nature everywhere. I suppose what matters is how we integrate this consumerism into the realities. And if Africa has been under huge pressure, as it has, for instance, with the sweeping urbanization in the last 30 to 40 years that has occurred, some of it out of control, then it's very difficult for ordinary people to resist the pressures of consumerism. Everywhere in Africa I go now, even the most remote places, they're all watching CNN, they're watching Sky, they're watching France 24. The world is there in their small sitting room. Furthest in the middle of Africa, they're all watching what's happening in America, Asia. We have to accept that that is the reality. And like all human beings, they like and they see what they want. And so consumerism is a reality that's going to be just always part. And then again, you have a huge market there. So you have international companies very happy to be able to sell their goods into an African continent that's waiting to receive them. The problem is it doesn't very often have the resources to pay for them. So they borrow against future earnings, either from the mines or from some other resources, with the result that, you know, maybe the money doesn't always go where it should, to education, health. So, like, consumerism is a reality. It's just human beings everywhere looking at the same and wanting it. Now, how you integrate that then into the reality of your own cultural background, of being able to, if you like, wisely judge how you should or should not spend. But look at the craziness that's happened in our world here in Europe and America, where our bankers, whom we thought were somebody, became just loose gamblers, you know, and have led to the ruin of many good people who entrusted them with their money. So, you know, human nature and original sin seems to be very widespread.
And my thanks there go to Synod Father and Superior General of the Society for African Missions, Father Kieran O'Reilly, for helping us better understand this meeting taking place in the Vatican known as Synod for Africa, often presided over by Pope Benedict himself. Meanwhile, as promised last week, it's time for the second part of my series marking the 400th anniversary of the founding vision of Mary Ward, an occasion which has brought over 200 of her followers to Rome this week, an effort to mark this joyful event. So do stay tuned, as in a few moments we no longer look at her story, which you can find on our website at www.vaticanradio.org, but at the reasons behind a choice of a name for one branch of her followers, the Rome branch. It's Congregation of Jesus, or Congregatio Jesu, a title which may have brought to mind the Society of Jesus. And if you tuned in to part one of this series, you recall how last week we learned how Mary Ward in 1611 wrote that she'd heard distinctly, not in sound of voice, but in intellectual understanding, the words "take the same as the Society." Stay tuned. This story begins at the time of the Second Vatican Council, when religious congregations were encouraged, in an effort to go forward, to look back at the original charism of their founders.
Mary Ward's charism was so clearly Ignatian. We set up various commissions to study what it meant to have the full constitutions of the Jesuits and whether, in fact, the Jesuits and the Church would ever allow, after 400 years, a women's congregation to take these constitutions.
Mr. Francis Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, sat down with me here in our studios and explained how the Jesuit constitutions Mary Ward had called for 4 centuries ago were finally adopted in 2003, not without much soul-searching and not without the permission of the Church and the Society of Jesus. Constitutions adopted almost in their entirety. That's if you exclude anything relating to priesthood. But the question that comes to mind is, why did the followers of Mary Ward have these constitutions so much at heart after all these centuries?
Ignatius of Loyola, when he called his congregation the Jesuits, saw the entire concept as being in the following of Jesus. And Mary Ward also wanted them also to have the name of Jesus in their title. Because she never persuaded the Jesuits to let that happen, and the Church in the end suppressed her, she never gave her congregation a name.
Mary Ward may not have given her congregation a name, but plenty of others did, nicknaming her and her followers Jesuitesses or Galloping Girls in a deliberate, derogatory manner. That's during her lifetime. Subsequently, as the congregation survived and developed, it took on a very obvious name, natural at least in Germany and Italy, that of the English Ladies. It was only in the 18th century that the order actually took a specific name, that of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a title accepted by the two branches of this order, the Roman one we spoke of earlier, now called the Congregation of Jesus, and that other Irish Loreto one, that never changed that name. Convinced a diverging approach to their names must have created an issue, I asked Sister Frances if, in 2003, their change of name had provoked mixed feelings.
Yes, I think feelings were enormously mixed between those who'd been working hard for this, who were absolutely overjoyed and enthusiastic, to those who felt a little bit that, you know, we've got very used to the title Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary. It looks as if we're moving away from Mary. There was a feeling, of course, that both branches had the same title. Now one branch would retain the title, the other would adopt Congregatio Jesu. You know, was that a consideration? But in fact, I find in practice, I am pleased that we have the name Jesus because it's what Mary Ward wanted.
Was there any reaction on the part of the Jesuits?
No, not at all, because they had been kept informed of our intentions right from the start. The Jesuits are aware of the history of their relationship with the congregation, which has not always been smooth. Even at the time of Mary Ward, there were some Jesuits who supported her wholeheartedly, including initially Father John Gerard, a seminary priest in England, the only person ever to have escaped from the Tower of London. Later on, when his provincial ordered him out of England after the gunpowder plot and he moved to the continent, he became Mary Ward's confessor. And it was probably through him that she got hold of her copy of the Jesuit Constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of the Jesuit Constitutions.
It was difficult to get hold of.
I mean, they weren't. Not like today.
You
go to the bookshop
again.
That's
right. No. That didn't work like that. Not all Jesuits had their own copy. But Mary Ward certainly had a copy because she copied large chunks of it by hand. Because she needed to know and understand what it was that she felt God was calling her to take on.
All very well, I thought to myself. That's the history of it all, but what about the followers of Mary Ward today? Where do they put her charism into practice, and how? I knew that, like the Jesuits, they were keen on education. So I put the question to Sister Frances once again, who remarked that this was possibly because education was one of the few areas that the Church once allowed women to be involved in. But she added, since Vatican II, her order began working in different continents and became involved in all areas where their presence, they felt, was most needed. Areas such as healthcare, social work, spiritual direction, and indeed in the media. Remarks which prompted a question. Does this mean that since Vatican II, you've had a different type of formation?
Yes, I think it does. It has followed the Ignatian concept of formation much more. If you're forming people to go out into tough mission areas, you have to form them to be people who can not only have a deep personal devotion to God, who are prepared to face hardships and difficulties, who are prepared to take initiatives, to adapt according to local circumstances as the need may be. In the Jesuit Constitutions, it makes it very clear that the training in obedience is absolute. But once the member gets out to the mission, he's going to make his own decision as to what actually is required, because his local superior may be a very long way away and out of communication. So that you are forming people interiorly so that they can be people of discernment. Discernment is a very, very important concept, that you learn interiorly to listen to the movement of the Spirit as to what you are being called to do. And then you would normally discuss this with your superior. But if you're out on the mission field and you've got to make a decision on your own, you make that decision. Now, we wouldn't, of course, even today have sisters out in tough areas on their own.
Can you work in areas like, for example, STEM springs to mind, like Zimbabwe?
Yes, Zimbabwe particularly. We're very involved in the moment, particularly with our clinics trying to provide medical services to you know, very poor rural villages.
Under difficult circumstances.
Under extremely difficult circumstances. Or we'd be working with tribals in North India, or working now in Mongolia.
What are you doing in Mongolia?
Well, we're working under the bishop, providing basic catechesis, because there are not many Christians in that part of the world. Now we have sisters in Siberia, we have them in the Ukraine, we have them in Cuba.
So right across the world?
Right across the world. Wherever the church has expressed a particular need and we have felt able to respond to it. So that, you know, it isn't we're always in this place, always in that place, always in schools. There is now much more diversity.
Have you ever felt in your life that you were in the wrong order, that you'd chosen to join the wrong order?
No, I've never felt that. But I have watched with interest the development of the congregation, because when I entered many years ago, I entered the congregation in a very well-established house, in a very well-established province. But I was young enough not to know really the difference between a semi-enclosed congregation and an apostolically active congregation. And looking back on it, I can see it was probably pretty semi-enclosed, because all congregations were before the Vatican Council. You had just sort of gradually had to compromise to get the recognition from the church. Well, in all our provinces, we reviewed what our ministries were, what our formation was. And because we were often in education, it was felt, no, the work in education, because you're forming people who are going to be of influence elsewhere in life of the church and in society, that is still a good work to be involved in. In other places, we may have decided that we weren't going to have the sisters to continue to keep some of these better-known educational establishments going, and therefore we had to begin the process of gradual transition to lay leadership. But that has gone on the whole very well. And that has released sisters for other work, to retrain for social work or go into spiritual ministries.
Is Mary Ward still the greatest inspiration to you?
Without doubt. She's become increasingly an inspiration.
What do you like most about her?
I love her warmth and humanity. I love her total single-minded adherence to what she was convinced God was calling her. And I love her lack of bitterness. She had no bitterness against the authorities at all. When her congregation was suppressed, and when she really understood it had been suppressed and it was not just a rumour, she accepted it as the will of God. And she encouraged her sisters to pray for our enemies. She's a real reconciler.
Our thanks there to Sister Frances Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus. By the way, the process which will put Mary Ward on the path to sainthood is currently underway. And I'll soon be bringing you an interview with the relator for the cause of her beatification, Father Peter Gumpel, a Jesuit who also happens to be a historian and theologian. Meanwhile, best wishes to the 3,000 followers of this charismatic woman. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.